This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today, we're going to talk to one of our co-hosts, or our only co-host. Kelly Chase is going to be with us today, and we are talking about a whole lot of things, because I want to say this about Kelly. Kelly is one of the most articulate people in this field. And she came into it seemingly out of nowhere, but we're going to find out more about that in a minute. And I love having her on Dreamland. And Cosmosis is a brilliant show that she does. She's part of the Experiencer community, and she is just a wonderful, fascinating person. What we're going to do today is we're going to go through a number of names: David Grush, Jake Barber, Lou Elizondo, John Blitch, and probably some others as we go along, and discuss both what they are doing and trying to do, and how successful the disclosure process has been so far, and matters, because is it actually the most important thing? Is that really what we need? Are we waiting for a moment when someone at a high level officially says, yes, they're here, or is something else going to unfold? Okay, Kelly, welcome to Dreamland. Let's get started.
Whitley, thanks so much for having me and for the kind words. It's an honor to do all of this with you.
Oh, well, great. I'm glad you feel that way. Let me ask you first, you're a mystery person to a lot of people in this field. You came out of sort of nowhere into a field which is notably, it has not got many female, there's you, there's Linda Moulton Howe, and a few others who are engaged in this. It was a boys' club when I started out. I remember how openly offended a lot of the people in MUFON were that Anne was even allowed to speak in my, it was just amazing. I mean, you talk about feminism hadn't happened in the UFO community in the 1980s. It's there now, fortunately, and you're a big part of that. Where did you start?
Well, I had been living a pretty normal life up until August of 2021, and I was an atheist. I was a strict materialist. I wasn't interested in any of this stuff at all. It wasn't even on my radar. But over that summer, I had started seeing these stories about UFOs in the news, and I got really invested. And after a few months of really tackling this and trying to get to the bottom of what was going on, I ended up having an anomalous experience kind of out of nowhere one morning, where I felt like I had sort of an out of body, kind of not even just out of body, but kind of out of time and space experience where I saw like kind of my entire life and a lot of things. I was sort of outside of time. It was a really overwhelming experience. It's hard to kind of talk about in a concise way. I did an episode about it on my podcast, The UFO Rabbit Hole, called Through the Looking Glass, if anybody wants more details about that. But suffice it to say, it changed me on every conceivable level in about 2 minutes, just one morning, where I came out of that experience and suddenly found myself back in my body and back in my room where it had happened. And I realized that everything about me had changed, that I believed in God, that I understood that I had a purpose for my life and that everyone has a purpose for their life. And I also understood that I needed to do this work, that like this field, strange as it sounds, that this needed to be the place where I focused my efforts and attention. And I started the podcast a couple of months later, and it's just been a very, very bizarre, strange chapter of my life. I never saw any of this coming. I didn't expect any of this. This isn't something that I would have sought out for myself, but it was something that I felt deputized by something I still don't know what to do. And so here I am.
Wow. A familiar story. I had had this happen to me as in my childhood. Apparently, I have very little direct memory of it, just enough to know that, yeah, it probably did happen. When I say direct memory, I mean memories that aren't under hypnosis. But when I was under hypnosis by Dr. Donald Klein, he said, at one point, "How old are you?" And I heard my little voice say 12. And I thought, what the hell's going on? I'm not 12, I'm 40 years old. And he said later that he had often hit people who had had traumatic experiences as children, and they would not necessarily remember those experiences during the session, but he would hear a change in their voice when they went back to that time. And I'm wondering, do you think there was anything like that in your life? That, can you remember any moment in your early life that might have had planted the seed?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of experiencers that the fact that up until, 2021, I didn't believe in any of that stuff, but that doesn't mean it wasn't happening in my life. I think a lot of experiencers, when you look back, you realize that there was a lot more going on that you just weren't processing or acknowledging. One event in particular that was very much tied to 2021 for me was, and it was a thing that got me into all of this, was that when I was 13 years old, I was at the Outer Banks with my family, and I was out late one night looking at the stars by myself outside, and I had this strange thought that I'd never had before in my life, which was that if I look up right now, I'll see a UFO. And I looked up, and there was this bright white light in the sky. And that was moving across the sky. And I wouldn't have thought it was anything but a plane, except that the second I looked at it, it did two quick right turns, like hard right turns, and then just went phew, like across the horizon faster than I'd ever seen anything move. And that was so strange because it really was kind of like a voice in my head saying, like, look up, like there, you'll see a UFO. And I ran inside and I told my family and they all thought I was crazy. And it's not that I forgot it, but I didn't have anywhere to put it or to any way to deal with it. And so I just kind of moved on with my life and I didn't think about it much after that. But it was in 2021 when I first started hearing about these, UFO stories in the news, because I had been not paying attention at all. Like I wasn't aware of anything that was going on. It was right before I was about to go back to the Outer Banks with my family. And I thought, ah, well, I'm there. I'll read about UFOs and I'll get to the bottom of this. Obviously, I didn't get to the bottom of it, but I do wonder, those two things are very connected for me and it brought me back around to this at like a very specific time in my life. And I do feel like there are a million things like that, but that in particular felt like a very specific seed that was kind of planted for me to come back to later.
I want to go back to the mention that you had of being outside of time, because this is very critical. When you're outside of time, that means your ego is shut down, because we are in the time stream, and our ego is what keeps us here. When the ego is shut down, everything changes. That's when you take LSD, for example, the parts of the brain that maintain the ego get they literally get paralyzed by LSD, and all hallucinogenics are the same way, and you end up seeing into, in some cases, a very, like with ayahuasca, it's a much more sophisticated thing than LSD, which is, ayahuasca is something that was developed by people with high levels of spiritual understanding, which is why often on ayahuasca people will go to a very specific place, or DMT is the same way. But LSD was a scientific created by scientists who didn't know about that, so the experience that it gives you is kind of random. But you went out of time on your own, and you had an awareness, therefore, of the sacredness of this experience. Now, in the question, my question becomes, do you have any idea why you went out of time?
I was kind of told why. And it was because I had to. I'm very stubborn. And I, my
Join
world,
the
right?
club.
But my worldview was very rigid. And I was so certain that I knew the answers to everything. And, some very strange things have happened to me in my life. I got a phone call from my dad a couple of months after he died, where he told me things that like I couldn't have known otherwise. And so it's not like I haven't had anomalous experiences. I just refused to integrate them. And I saw through my experience when I was outside of time that all of that was necessary. And that all of that was that in some ways it was damaging to me. Like I really came away with an understanding that like my disconnection from, God or source or whatever people want to call it, and my denial of my soul and my purpose had been something that had done me spiritual damage over time. And that it was necess but that it was necessary because I needed to, at this point in my life, that was going to be a tool for me, that it was going to be important for me to bridge the gap and be able to talk to people who were in that place of denial of that aspect of their humanity. And that I needed both the time of denial, and I also, when the time came, needed to be dragged by my hair, essentially, and shown what the truth was because I wasn't going to come to it any other way.
Now, we brushed past, or you brushed past very casually, a phone call you received from your dad after he died. Now, I don't think I'm the only person listening to this who's interested in more of a call. So, can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. So my dad passed away when I was 20 from a really sudden and aggressive cancer. And I'd spent a lot of time with him right before he died, taking care of him, and he had always said that if he could contact me, he would. I didn't really believe that he could at that point in my life. But a few months after he died, this maybe 2 or 3 months later, I was asleep one night. And this is one of those stories I didn't tell for a long time because, the part that like where I was asleep and then I woke up and then I went back to sleep, and people think it's like, oh, it's just a dream. But like, anyways, it's fine if people don't believe that. But I had had it was an old phone, like back before even flip phones, and I had had this little light on it programmed so that when it was my dad calling, this red light would flash because I never wanted to miss his calls because he had been so sick. And his phone was still on at that point because we would call it sometimes to like l listen to his voice on the voicemail.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it
I've
took,
done that with Anne.
yeah. Yeah. Those little things become like treasures after someone's gone. And
Yes.
so I saw my phone was ringing and I woke up and I saw that the red light was flashing. And I literally thought I was dreaming. I was like, what's going on? But I looked and it was my dad calling. And I picked up the phone. And it was my dad. And he was very, sorry, this probably makes me a little emotional because he was very mad at me. Like he was livid. Like he was so furious with me. And he said to me, where is your brother? And I was like, I don't know where he is. And he was like, I left you in charge. And like where like you need to find your brother. And he told me some things that I won't share just because it's my brother's personal life, but he was in some trouble at the time and I didn't really know where to find him, but was able to find him based on what my dad told me. And I went and found him. But the next day, it was so weird. These things and anomalous experiences that don't make sense, is that I got that call and I cried, but then I just went back to sleep. And I woke up the next morning really thinking it was a dream. And I looked at the phone and I did have this incoming call from my dad in the middle of the night. And so
Wow.
I called my stepmom because she still had his phone. And she told me that the day before was the day that she had turned his phone, that she had finally like cut the line off, basically. And so I think I kind of always, not that it really made any sense, but I kind of told myself like something had just happened in that process of the phone getting turned off, that it had like accidentally called me and that I had just had this dream or something. But that's just how I dealt with the world at the time, but it was very strange because there was a missed call the next day.
That's really interesting. It's really interesting. You know, I had an encounter with my dad recently. I've had two of them since he died. The first one was when I had a, I was trying to, when I was still trying to figure out the communion thing, someone told me about out of body experiences, which I knew nothing about, and I got Bob Monroe's book. Then the copy I had gotten, fortunately still have, had the exercise in the back of it that they took out later. And I used the exercise one night and it worked, and I got out of my body. This was after the communion experience, and I saw what looked like a, as I sort of moved around in my bedroom, I saw what looked like a African mask of a gray in the window. And I should have known that that meant that they had done this and that I hadn't gotten out of my body on my own, but I was very innocent then. And I thought, I've done it. I've done it. Now I can do it all the time. I'm going to have such a cool time with this. Then I tried to get back in. I couldn't get, kept slipping out of it. And suddenly there's my dad mowing the lawn, which I hated to do. And he looks at me and he says, "When are you going to come help me?" Bang, I'm back in my body immediately. The next
Oh, wow.
next experience with Dad was a few weeks, a few days ago, about a week ago. I'm tasked to get up and do a meditation at 3 o'clock every morning, or thereabouts. It's actually an hour and a half before dawn, or an hour and 46 minutes for before dawn, or something like that. I forget. Anyway, I'm waked up. If I, they. Sometimes I can wake myself up, but if I don't wake myself up, I will be waked up by the presence or whatever it is. And this time it happened to be my dad. And I thought, geez, it's Dad. And then I realized he's pointing a gun at me and he fires the gun in my face.
Oh my
That woke
gosh.
me right up, boy. And I thought to myself, damn, Whitley, you don't know whether that was actually Dad or it was you using your memories of Dad, who could get pretty mad at times, to wake yourself up. Anyway, go do the meditation. And so that's the two things. I don't know. So we both had some kind of interaction with our dads. I think yours is more true than mine, more real, and more certain to be actually an anomalous experience and not part of you. Although I think that human beings are entirely anomalous. So I don't. Okay,
Yes.
let's talk a little bit about. I want to. You have your new show, you're doing it with J. Christopher King, a person I have high regard for. He's a remarkable man, and tell us a little bit about. And I'm going to interview Jay on this show soon, sooner or later,
Oh, great.
I want to know how you came together and why you're working together. But before we find that out, and then we're going to go, speaking of UFO rabbit holes, we're going down, way down the rabbit hole into the place where David Grush, Jake Barber, Lou Elizondo, John Blitch, and others live. We'll be right back. We're back. We're talking to Kelly Chase. You can reach Kelly at cosmosis.media. I suggest you do that. And Kelly is Dreamland's host every once a month. And don't miss her shows. They are excellent. Excellent. And just because it's not me doesn't mean it's not great. It happens to be great. Kelly knows what she's doing. Okay, before we left the air, as we used to say when these things were going out over the air, I don't know what we're leaving now, but we left something. And you looked at some of you looked at some ads, and some of you, the wise and intelligent subscribers, didn't. In any case, J. Christopher King, Kelly Chase find their way into each other's universes. And those are two very big universes. Tell us about that meeting.
You know, in some ways, I feel like Jay is one of the people I've met in my life that I'm most karmically linked to. It felt very inevitable from the moment we met. We originally met when he did the Inquire Anomalous conferences in New York City. He asked me to co-host the first two of those with him. And I had never talked to Jay at that point when he gave me that invitation. I didn't know him. He had listened to the podcast, and I had, I was a little bit familiar with him from some other podcasting work he was doing in an article that Ralph Blumenthal had written about some experiencers, and Jay was one of them. And so I went out to the conference, and it was kind of a whirlwind for me. I'd only been podcasting for a few months, and nobody really knew who I was, and I was brand new to the whole world, just kind of a babe in the woods. But I don't know. Jay and I, our friendship was really, really natural. I feel like from the minute I met him, I was just like, I understand you, I get you, and I like you. And we just became friends really, really naturally, and from a shared sense of humor, I think more than anything else. We have a very similar kind of dark body sense of humor that we don't necessarily put out there publicly, but we crack each other up. And it was interesting because at that point, I had started doing the podcast. My entire life had changed as a result of it, but I still wasn't identifying as an experiencer because the experience that I had and was so strange and so different from kind of the conceptions I had in my head because I was still so new to that. Like I'm still today, I'm very still new to the field, but back then I really knew nothing. And so I was going through this process of coming to terms with what had happened to me, but also mostly ignoring what had happened to me because I wasn't ready to deal with it. And so I developed this really natural friendship with Jay, for who people who don't know is actually the co-founder and director of the Experiencer Group and quite a profound experiencer himself. And so it was really kind of fated for me in a way, and so helpful at that moment in my life to have that. Have already kind of established this trust and friendship with Jay, and then to be going through kind of my own awakening and understanding of what had happened to me. And so we really kind of bonded through that and realized that we had a lot of shared vision for the kind of work that we wanted to do and where we'd like to see the field go. And I think that our skill sets really align. Jay is a really talented artist and filmmaker. He went to film school and he had a television production background. And, I'm kind of more on the a writer and I have like a marketing and PR background. He's somebody who's been dealing with the anomalous in very profound ways since he was very young. And I was somebody who was just very fresh to it. And I think that both of those perspectives coming together has been really powerful for us in sort of honing a message that is both deep, but has kind of the accessibility and the range, hopefully, to reach people who are outside of the experiencer community as well to help them understand, what that's all about and hopefully educate some people on that. So, yeah, we came together really naturally. And I think at the point that we started working together, it had already sort of felt like we had been working together just because we had been talking so much about our work and supporting each other's work and hanging out socially. And so it was the most natural progression in the world. And now I just couldn't even imagine not working with Jay.
Well, great, because you do great work together, and I'm glad you're tight because you need to stay tight. I order you to. Anyway, it's a great partnership, and you went from the UFO rabbit hole to Cosmosis. Why did you make that change? I love the UFO rabbit hole graphics and the title and everything, and I
Yeah.
like Cosmosis. It's absolutely beautifully produced. It
Oh,
really
thank you.
is.
Thank you. Yeah, we were, I love the UFO rabbit hole, and it was kind of my first baby, and I will always have a lot of affection for it. I felt like in some ways I outgrew it pretty quickly because when I started, it was really me just sharing my own trip down the rabbit hole and just trying to asking each episode was me basically just like asking the next logical question I had about what the heck was going on with all of this. And then I'd go and research it and then I'd go back and share with the audience, what I had found. And I think that that was really helpful for me at the time because, they always say a way to know if you really know something is to teach it to somebody else. And so I think that it forced me to kind of not just stay on the surface, but to go deep and to make sure that I actually understood things before I moved on. And so that was really helpful. But really quickly over time, I started joking that the UFO rabbit hole was a UFO podcast where I never talked about UFOs because I progressively got more into, all of the other rabbit holes that you can go down around that. And the craft itself is kind of the least interesting thing to me personally. And so it felt like it was time to kind of move on and evolve and to open the aperture because I found that I was really interested in things like consciousness and human potential and, the nature of our reality and those kinds of questions, because I think that like all of this, the anomalous and UFOs and all of that is kind of couched within these larger questions that so many of us have about like what the heck the our reality is and what we're doing here and all of that. So it just felt like it was time to move on, but I'll always have a big place in my heart for the UFO rabbit hole.
Okay, well, speaking of rabbit holes, we're going to take another break and then we're going to go down a real rabbit hole with some very extraordinary rabbits that we've already talked about their names. We'll be right back. We're talking to Kelly Chase, Dreamland's co-host today and the host, co-host also with J. Christopher King. Of Cosmosis. The website is cosmosis.media, and you can find Cosmosis also on the internet, on YouTube. And what's the best search term to use on YouTube?
Just Cosmosis, and you'll find us. Yep.
Interestingly enough, that won't happen if you search for Dreamland. Even though Dreamland has been around since 1998, and we have professional SEO people working on it. If you search YouTube for Dreamland, you're not going to find us. And that's not unintentional. And I'm glad to see that Cosmosis is not having that part problem. It's called being shadow banned. And you're not banned. You're not easy to find. And that's sort of
Right.
where we are. But I've been in this world for so long. It's just water off a duck's back. Remember the movie Trains, Planes, and Automobiles when now I'm gonna stop here. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Let me make a little break here, Kelly, and I can start and cut that out. In 2017, the New York Times published a historic story. Of course, everyone knows what it is. It's the Tic Tac story. And it changed the world. And fortunately, two of our dear friends, Ralph Blumenthal and Leslie Kane, were involved in that. And I've always been so proud of them for that. They actually got that story in the New York Times, a miracle. And it is literally a miracle because subsequently the New York Times has crawled back into its cave, and they don't publish anything like that anymore. And so it's too bad, but they could have taken from there and changed the world profoundly, but they did not choose to do that. They chose instead to, I guess, to defer to the Defense Department because I'm sure at some point they were told, if you keep doing this, you're not going to be welcome at the Defense Department. And we're not going to give you any more stories or any more scoops. And they were scared. And so they basically towed the line. That's my theory. Okay. But that started a ball rolling, and it's still rolling. Basically, quite a few people in the Senate and the House saw that story and thought to themselves, wait a minute, this is not what we're being told. Where is this? The DOD is not being straight with us. Now, flashback to the late 90s, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, their chief counsel, got in touch with me after I published a book called Majestic because they wanted to know how I knew all of the things that were in that book. And that's a long story, and they didn't get it. I'm still not going to give the whole story. In any case, the book's basically a work of fiction, but woven into it is the precise and generally correct story of the Roswell incident, which until that time was not known. I mean, it was known, but it wasn't known quite as that way. Okay, so they were trying then to get the National Security Agency to open up. They got in touch with me because they wanted help formulating questions for the NSA to answer when they were speaking to them in camera privately. They didn't ever go public, and they didn't get anywhere. Now, people are trying again. Can you tell us a little bit about what is happening? Because it's so complex. There's Arrow, there's all this other stuff, and I know you to a degree keep up with this. Tell us who the principal players are and how this works. It's woven into the Defense Department in such a way. I think there's a bottom line. I think the bottom line is the Defense Department and therefore the administration still control the flow of knowledge to Congress despite everything that has been attempted to change that.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that statement. I mean, I think that there's been a truly historic and heroic push for more transparency over, the last several years since 2017. I think that it's extraordinarily complicated, though. I think you have, I'm sure, even more visibility behind the scenes than I do about, the various relationships and the things that happen, but it can sometimes be a little shocking for people who I think imagine it's all one big happy family to understand like that there's factions and there's infighting and that a lot of these people have known each other for decades and they've got beef with each other from way back when or some kind of something that and so it can be it's difficult to get traction in some ways because there's people with all different kinds of objectives and all different backgrounds. Even the DoD itself is just a behemoth, and so it's hard to know exactly what's going on because we're dealing with different intelligence agencies. We're dealing with people who are contractors for various, aerospace and defense companies. And it's really hard to un and I don't think it's definitely not working hand in glove. There's in some ways like a bit of a warring for the it's like people fighting over the remote in some ways. And sometimes you can see that hand fighting a little more obviously than others in terms of who's going to get to kind of control the conversation. It kicked off in 2017 with Lou Elizondo and to the STARS Academy, and that seemed to create like an initial center of gravity in the field and sort of a directionality to it. And like, here are the people who are stepping forward, and this is who we're looking to. And it kicked this whole thing off. But over time, that's all gotten a little bit more complicated as like more people have kind of entered the conversation as some people have left the conversation. We have entities like the Galileo Project in Seoul working on things on kind of like the academics and humanities side. And yet those organizations are also inevitably tied up with the intelligence community as well, whether they intend to be or not. And it feels like it feels a little bit like barely contained chaos. And I think especially this last year with the whistleblower Jake Barber coming forward in a big report that he did with Ross Coulthart and the kind of rise of the Skywatcher, that we're seeing like this whole new paradigm of people who weren't in the conversation before, who are suddenly emerging. And now it seems like we don't just have defense contractors and various intelligence agencies and then like independent journalists and enthusiasts and advocates, but we also now suddenly have, kind of tech billionaires and all kinds of different groups coming in trying to kind of get some kind of foothold in this situation. And it's very difficult to make sense of it from one day to the next or to know what's going on.
We're going to take another little break. We'll be right back. We're back. We're talking with Kelly Chase, our podcast and documentary, Cosmosis. her website, cosmosis.media, and we're just getting ready to talk about some of the principals who are involved in this whole now really complicated disclosure movement. And the question is, what do we want? What do people want? I think most people are looking for disclosure in the sense of the president sitting across the desk in the Oval Office saying, they're here. That's sort of a lot of people's assumed bottom line. I think that, well, I'm not going to get into what I think. This is so complex. It's the most complex single experience the human species has ever had, by far. It represents a total change in the then in what human life is. It's that big. Now let's go to start with the tech billionaires who have become interested in this because they all see remarkable technology, and they want to get that technology and emulate it. Now, this is exactly what the DoD has been trying to do for 60 years, and it's a boneyard of failures so far. And the Chinese and the Russians have been trying to do it also, and each group has had some successes, small successes, but basically nothing huge, no breakthroughs. And there's something wrong. And I think what's wrong is something I say to the people who are working on the materials every time I get my ch a chance to. When you work on these materials, look at these materials. Remember, they're looking back at you. They're looking back at you. And that's because this isn't about just technology. It's about that timeless experience that you had. It's about living and functioning from that level, and that is when that tech will make sense. So what are we going to get, do you think, from psionics guys and people with dog whistles, as they call them, calling up flying saucers or orbs and stuff? Are they going to get anything from that?
I don't know. They might get some technology. The technology part of this is so is shrouded in mystery more than just about any other part of it. So it's hard to know, like as an outsider, what the probability of that is. But I think you're right, and I think I tend to be skeptical about the idea that they're going to get anything that they can make much use of. And for the reasons you stated, I wonder though, and I think that like that's always going to be something that people are going to pursue. Obviously, advanced
Yeah, of
technology and
course.
technology on that level is a game changer in terms of geopolitics and et cetera, et cetera. I do wonder if that is maybe not the only point or objective of a lot of this, which is that for better or worse, the UFO phenomenon is a vehicle for belief systems and for changing how people think about themselves and think about the world. And there's so much lore and mythology kind of mixed up in all of that. And, we're living in a culture that's kind of like soul blind and kind of, so there are definitely a lot of people out there who have very meaningful spiritual lives, but that's not like the default in our culture anymore. This kind of deeper understanding of the nature of reality and what it means to be a human is something that's kind of calcified and kind of crusted over in our culture. And I am concerned about people leveraging the UFOs and the anomalous and all of this in ways that could be used intentionally to change the beliefs or to influence the beliefs of large numbers of people, whether that be about their beliefs about certain technology or certain threats from adversaries, or whether that be beliefs about, God or aliens or whoever else. I think that in some ways that is, at least to me, looks like the more pressing danger than them getting their hands on technology, because I don't think they're going to get their hands on anything they can use. It's just my suspicion.
Yeah, I think if they were going to get their hands on something that they could use, that would have happened.
Well, and
And
they
I
wouldn't
think
be making a show out of it, right? Like Skywatcher is literally like doing this stuff, taking people out to the desert, bringing certain podcasters and influencers out there to do this stuff, filming it all. They would not be filming it if they thought that they were going to get technology that was going to be useful for them. Or at least they wouldn't be putting that out.
I wondered when I saw all of that whether or not Skywatcher is on some subtle level designed to make us feel helpless. Not probably by the people who did it, who are doing it, spending the money and building the technology and whistling up the UFOs and whatever they're doing, but by some other level that maybe is in control of their minds in some way, setting us up for failure so that we end up in a situation where we've tried publicly, privately, secretly, and now publicly tried and failed again and again and again. And at the same time, the environment is going to be collapsing around us. And so, in a few years, we're going to be desperate to get out of this planet somehow. And we're not going to have anything except rockets. And let's face it, that is not going to fly. So, they are going to fly, but just not the right way. So, it's a kind of, where in the world do we go from here? And how do we make this work for ourselves in some way? And you mentioned soul blindness. That's the key to it. I think that we live in a Cartesian prison. We are in the jail of the physical world. And you and I have both had extensive spiritual experiences, but we mostly live day to day in a little corner of reality where we are physically comfortable, like goldfish in a bowl. And we've got to figure out how to get out of that bowl. Now, this is going to seem like a crazy segue, but it actually isn't. It's only a semi-crazy segue. But I want to move from here into the whole disclosure movement and the behind it. It was, I know it was brought up during the last year in October of the end of the George W. Bush administration, because Hal Putoff has now talked about it publicly and told me about it privately years ago, that a group of people assembled at the White House or in Washington and in separated into committees. And the idea was to each committee to get to come together and come away back with a recommendation as to whether or not the president should disclose. Everyone went into it thinking, yeah, we should do this now. Everyone came out of it saying, no, we can't. And they didn't do it. And then at the end of the Obama administration, I know there was a big move for Obama to finally release the UFO files, and he wouldn't do it. Now you go back, and then it was never really addressed in the Biden years. And it was never addressed in the first Trump administration. I mean, God knows things were so crazy at that point that they didn't have with COVID and everything, this wasn't going to come to the surface. The jury's still out on the present Trump administration. But you go back, like, what is it, 17 or 18 administrations, and every one of them has hidden this. You go back into the 50s and Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter convening a conference with Congress saying, let's do this, let's disclose the truth, went nowhere. Kelly, do you have any sense of the huge resistance to this that people like David Grush, Jake Barber, Lou Elizondo, John Blitch, and Hal Putoff and others are up against? What are they really up against, do you think?
I mean, I think the thing that we're really up against is that our government and the Department of Defense in particular is absolutely not set up for transparency. It's not what they've been charged with. Well, they have in terms of the Constitution. But when you look at something in terms of like how the DoD has exploded, really, especially since after the Second World War and all of the secrecy and the siloing and all of that, all of their decision making is made through a matrix of risk assessment. It's always about like the most important thing is maintaining the stability of the state of the country. And the problem with that is that I don't think that that's something that we're ever really going to overcome because they're never going to be able to totally know how people are going to respond to this. I think that many crimes by many people have been committed over decades, that there's all kinds of questions about liability and also ownership of technology and a million things that make this so complicated that, like, I don't think that the reward and the is ever going to outweigh the risk from that perspective. Like that's it's meant to maintain itself, to protect itself, and to maintain stability. And I think in some ways we're asking these like esoteric questions of the Department of Defense because we feel like they know things that we don't, and they do know things that we don't. But the things that they know are about the nature of our reality. I'm kind of like resistant to this idea that they like somehow know something that we can't know other than through them. And I don't think, and but I think that for us to make any, I don't believe that real disclosure is going to come from the government. And I'm like, some people might find that to be cynical. In some ways, I find it to be liberating because it moves the question to another arena, which is, kind of a more human one and one that I think is probably more humane in general.
I think that recently, wait a minute, I'm going to have to pause this for a second. I lost you. Zoom went away. Something. Okay, I'm going to just pause. There was recently a guest on Weaponized, Matthew Brown, who said a very interesting thing. It was a three-part, 3 1-hour interviews. And in the third interview, he said, "We live in a dream." And this gets me back to what you said earlier, which I think is a very crucial statement, that we're soul blind. And I have lived in this soul world very much and along for a long time. And not only it's not mystical at all. There's a science to it. It's part of the physical world that we don't believe exists. And we live in a dream because of that. What about that? I mean, aren't these people all, is the defense, do you sense that the secret that the Defense Department is hiding might not be so much the fact that there were all these people abducted and some killed and maimed in various ways and had their fetuses stolen from their bodies or the semen taken from them and on that that's not the only problem, that there's a bigger problem, and that is somebody else is in control of our souls? Could that be what he was alluding to?
I mean, it certainly could be. I think that, regardless, I think that the secret behind the UFO phenomenon is it has to do with the soul and has to do with human potential and has to do with what we're capable of. If we even look at the modern disclosure movement that we're talking about right now, all of this can be traced back to OSAP, and all of that can be traced back to Bigelow and NIDS, and from before that, you can trace it back to the Advanced Theoretical Physics Working Group, and you can trace that back to, the Stargate Project. And that's
Right.
where, like, all of these people who still are doing the podcast circuit, who still, in a lot of ways, are leaders and people we look to within the community, it all goes back to the remote viewing programs. And I think that human potential is at the heart of the secrecy. Now, whether that means that like our souls are somehow being utilized by someone or some of the scarier ideas that are out there. I mean, I think that we have to entertain those things as possibilities, partly just because we know so little about ourselves, about our souls, about what it really does mean
Yes.
to be human. So it's hard to rule things out. But I think even more than that, I don't think they want us to know how powerful we are. You know, if remote, there are elite remote viewers, but almost anyone can do it. And what does that say for national
Right.
security? What does that say for, and if we can develop telepathy, if we can, you know, we're a much harder to control population if we are aware of who we are and what we can do. At least that's my belief.
Well, I think if the public became reliably telepathic, the politicians would have to move to another planet after
Yes.
immediately. They'd have to get out of here. But that so far hasn't happened. It does happen, like in my life, it happens every once in a while. I have telepathic moments, and I think anybody who's had telepathy with the visitors is probably in the same boat. They have occasional telepathic moments because their minds. You know, when you're with the Greys, for example, it's all telepathy. They don't talk. They don't have vocal cords. So you're totally telepathic with them, and it feels like the most natural thing in the world. Then they go away, and you're not telepathic anymore. It feels very weird. But sometimes, you know, when I'm tired or in a certain state, I'm telepathic with the people around me. And it's you know, it's kind of interesting and kind of a creepy at the same time. And it only lasts a few minutes. It's only in my life. David Grush, what do you suppose his actual motivation was? Was he being pushed out? You know, he said something in front of the Congress. It's just a brief sentence in all of that testimony that it's something about him and his wife. I think they are experiencers. I don't think he's ever alluded to that, but I think they are. Because I think they had something happen to them together.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean,
No.
as you know, probably even better than I do, I think even the people who in this field who don't talk about being experiencers,
Yeah,
there are
well, none of
very
these
few
people
people
will, only
who aren't.
John Blitch will interview with me. The other three won't because they don't want to be tarred with the experience or brush. You know, we're too woo. But the truth is, you and me, the experiencer community, we're the leading edge of this. And another thing is, these egos are involved, and the Defense Department and the government want to stay in control of this at all costs. But I think as soon as it becomes public knowledge, they lose control of it the next minute. And it turns out that the experiencers are in control. Because the media goes to them and they don't have much useful to say. They come to the experiencers and they're people who have all kinds of relationships with the visitors. Like that book, UFO Sky Pilots. Have you ever read that?
No, I think I have it on my shelf somewhere, but I haven't read it yet.
Oh my, what a wonderful book. What it does is the author takes a number of UFO witnesses who have flown UFOs, and they all tell a version of the same story. They put their hands on something, and their souls go into the skin of the into the they become the UFO, and then they can fly it. And this is why no one in the Defense Department or in China or in Russia gets anywhere with this, because they don't that way. They're soul blind. Like you said, that was the most crucial thing you said in the whole show, I think, is they're soul blind. Therefore, they can't do this tech. They can't do it. But it is ultimately technology because it's soul-related technology. What do you think David Grush's motive was to come out? You must have thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to maintain a healthy level of skepticism about anyone coming forward, particularly members of the intelligence community. They're
Yes.
inevitably the people who have the information, but also, you know, when people's job is to lie to you, if that's what they've been tasked with, you know, you have to remain aware of that. It doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means that, like, you have to understand what your relationship to them is. And so you have to maintain a certain level of skepticism, I think. And I think that the community is not always great at doing that. But I tend to get the impression from David Grush that he's very sincere. And I,
I do too.
when I've heard him speak about, I do think that just because I'm skeptical about the disclosure movement doesn't mean that I don't believe that there are like good people involved who are probably have their hands tied in all kinds of ways that I can't imagine being outside of, the intelligence world, but that, but who have come across things and who truly believe that humanity has the right to know certain things about who we are and where we are and all of that. And David Grush strikes me, at least, I mean, I don't know him, I haven't spoken to him, but he strikes me as somebody that I think that was where his heart was.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion. Yeah.
Elizondo. Oh, by the way, it's the author of UFO Sky Pilots is Grant Cameron, and I'm going to have Grant on in the fall with some of the people he talked to, and we're going to really excavate this whole business of flying UFOs, because I only have one nanosecond memory of this. I just have one memory of it. But I'm sure it's accurate that because all these other people telling the same story, and I have this sort of free-floating memory of doing the same thing. I can't tell you when, I can't tell you where, I can't tell you anything about it except that I, at one point, put my hands on something and my soul swept out into this thing and I was flying and it was glorious. And I
Wow.
thought, I thought to myself, well, we fear about the fear of the soul being enslaved and used in tech. And I thought to myself, if that's what it's like, I'm there. I'm there. I'm definitely there. So now we have Lou Elizondo. He comes, and all of these guys are constrained in a way. They have what they say has to be approved. They haven't told anything out of court in that sense. So what are we w really dealing with? Are we d dealing with a kind of a drama, or are these people really exposing things that the government doesn't want them to expose? Because I don't think legally they can. I've read the Whistleblower Act. I don't think that they have to vet everything before they say it, or they get thrown in jail.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really complicated. I think there's
Yeah.
a fair debate about whether any of the whistleblowers actually are whistleblowers, in the traditional
Or they
sense.
have no independence of action, I don't think.
Right. And I think that like people will get really mad at me for kind of saying that I think that what we're seeing with the disclosure movement is theater, because I think it absolutely is theater. And that's not me. I don't think that that's 100% nefarious, and it doesn't mean that everyone involved is like a terrible person. I just think that, and also, I don't think that everyone involved understands that that's the case. In fact, I would assume that many people who are involved don't know that that's the case. But I think that when we're talking about the kinds of secrets that are this big, and you have to hide them not just from your own people, but from other countries. And that's become this like v much more complicated thing the more interconnected and like globalized we become as a species, because it's not like you can just, if you want to hide something from China or from Russia, that you just like can get all 350 million Americans in a room and be like, all right, guys, here's what's going on. But like, pinky promise that you're not going to tell Russia and China. Like,
Right,
like
they're
the
not going to happen.
information is everywhere. And so for them to lie to our adversaries and to kind of create all of these smoke screens around technology that's probably been being developed for decades. And this isn't just the UFO phenomenon. This is everything, right? This is everything from the Cold War and the space program on forward. There have been these huge smoke screens and entirely like alternate histories that have been erected to protect that information. And I think that disclosure to me looks like something that has never really been about transparency. It's always been about, I think that there are people who want more of it to come out and who do believe that we have a right to know more about the nature of our reality. I think that there are people who have very legitimate concerns about the ways that some of this advanced technology has been siloed and like squirreled off places without any oversight. I think that there are people who are concerned about technology transfer and legislation and all of that kind of thing. And that you need to, if you're going to have enough of that going on, there's going to be enough smoke. People are going to ask if there's fire. And I would just assume that they would have to build a smoke screen around that, something that would look very much like the disclosure movement that we're involved in, where like little things come forward over a long period of time. But every time you take a step forward, you take two steps back. It looks, Diana Pasulka actually just recently put out an article on her Substack talking, speculating about disclosure and kind of what's going on. And she made the case that there might be a group of people who have been studying this stuff for a long time and that they've always used this kind of spectacle and story and diversion as a smokescreen for what's really going on. And I think that that's just unfortunately how the world works in a lot of ways, and that this is an extreme example and like an example in microcosm that shows us how manufactured our reality is from the top down. I don't necessarily think it's like awful people doing awful things. I think it's just as I've gained a deeper understanding of how the intelligence community works, how the Department of Defense works, just how the world works, it's hard for me to not be pretty skeptical of what's going on from a on a high level.
We have reached the end of the first part of the show. We have a half hour to go. If you can stay with us, Kelly. Can you? You can.
Oh,
Okay,
yes,
good.
absolutely.
Okay, definitely. Free listeners, I urge you, as always, to subscribe to the show. It's well worth doing. You keep us going. You get a vast collection of material of all kinds, not just Dreamland, but other podcasts. And also, the news section of Unknown Country goes now back to 1998, and it is filled with amazing stories. Filled with amazing stories. And you can use the search engine to sort of explore. It's a place to explore. So get going and get some exploring done for $5 and $4.95 a month. We'll see you next week. Okay. We're talking to Kelly Chase, Cosmosis.media. Her podcast is Cosmosis, beautiful, incredible podcast. And they did she it did the Cosmosis documentary, very frankly, one of the best documentaries in the field. Where can you get the documentary? I can get it on Amazon or
Yes, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Vimeo, YouTube, Google Play. It's all kinds of places. And if you can't find it, go to cosmosis.media and all the links are at the website.
Great. Okay. A few weeks ago, Lou Elizondo is in Washington. He proceeds to show a picture that made him look like a bit of a fool because the picture was not real. Can you tell us a little bit about what you thought when you saw that happening and what it may have meant? Was he genuinely just making a mistake because he's inexperienced in dealing with the media about this? And I'm not saying he's inexperienced in the field. Obviously, he's not. But in dealing with the media about it, what happened, do you think, Kelly? What was going on there?
I don't know what happened. It was very, I'll say that it was disturbing on a lot of levels. I have, I mean, listen, I'll say I got into this field because of Lou Elizondo. He was somebody that I was really intrigued by early on and who I, it seemed like, you listen to him talk and you'd be like, wow, this guy has a lot of conviction, a lot of integrity. And I think I, like a lot of people, give him a lot of benefit of the doubt because, because of the 2017 article, because of the work that he's done. Because of the awareness of what a sacrifice that must be to come forward with information like that and what that must have done to him and his family. But it's hard sometimes to ignore, especially over the last year, some of the things that he's done that are baffling and are really hard to square with what we know about him. This image, he said that it was given to him by a pilot, that it was like very last minute. I will say that I have talked to several people who were around in DC for that event who, like, he was not just given that morning. There are dozens and dozens of people who know this, that it was shown around at least the night before, if not previously. So this wasn't as people, he does fun with words a little bit sometimes where he's like, I just was handed this piece of paper this morning, but like it was on his phone the night before, right? So, as people started looking into the provenance of this photo, not only was it not taken where he initially said it was taken, which was near Four Corners, which maybe he was told the wrong thing, but it was actually taken near Colorado Springs, which there's like Lockheed Martin and DARPA and like all kinds of stuff, kind of like very close by. It almost felt like some weird Easter egg in a way. It's also pretty apparent that this photo is not taken from from an airplane, that it was satellite imagery. And so you kind of have this like confluence of things that don't make sense about this photo. And ultimately, like, he had presented it and said that he was given to him by a pilot. He did say that it wasn't vetted, but I kind of think that's not the point or what people are concerned about. And that it looked like a disc, like a large UFO, like a very, very large UFO disc with a kind of shadow beneath it. But upon further inspection, it seemed pretty clear that it was just an irrigation circle, which is something that people find out in the desert. You see it all the time when you fly over dry areas. And I think that like it was disturbing to me and to a lot of people that he did it because, first of all, there was already another incident that happened right before the hearing in November, where he presented in a very similar fashion a photo that he said was given to him by like a pilot or a member of the military, I forget, who said that they had seen this, like he called it like a city of light in the sky. It was like some kind of like a mothership, but like you zoom in on it and you realize it's a reflection of like a dome light on a ceiling in a window of a building, and you can see somebody's hair under it, and like.
Right, I remember that.
Right. And so it's just like these two kind of like really obvious photos that ended up not being what he said they were. And if it was just that, I think maybe it would be a little easier to get past. But it's that there's so much of the story that doesn't make sense. Like him saying it was given to me by this pilot, and like he really came at people after people were upset and was like, I still believe this pilot, and I, but like it wasn't even taken out of a plane. You know what I mean? Like there's this like weirdness going on there where it doesn't seem like what he's saying is connecting to reality. And beyond all of that is the fact that this is a man who we know because he's told us and he wrote about it in his book, who has been a career counterintelligence official. And counterintelligence is an extremely complicated endeavor, but it certainly would involve understanding things like the power of an image and how the media works and how you would disseminate or leverage, how disseminate things through the media, how you would leverage the media, how you would avoid things getting into the media. And so to see him make these kinds of mistakes, to make it more than once, it's just a hard thing. It's a hard thing for people to accept. And then his lack of accountability about it afterward, I think, is even perhaps more disturbing. He put out this like 7-minute apology where he said, well, if it'll make people feel better, I'll apologize. But then the thing he was really apologizing for was that like he was sorry that people had gotten upset about this and that it had taken away from the day. But it's like, are we just supposed to ignore these major red flags and like as sort of the M he was kind of the MC of that event. He was leading that event. He's somebody who's been in this field for years and years, long before he was ever even public. He's a senior counterintelligence official with decades of experience, and it's just really hard to believe that he just made a mistake, and it's even harder to believe that he wouldn't know how to apologize well, even if he didn't mean it. And he didn't. He didn't apologize well. It was a terrible apology. And so it feels like he's self-sabotaging sometimes in ways that are like, why? Why are you self-sabotaging in this way? And I think that's the question that I have myself. I won't speak for anyone else, but that's the question that I have.
Well, what happened reveals one of two things: either that part of this whole journey of his has been to end with discrediting his own testimony. That's possible. Another possibility is, and I never can forget this, we are dealing with the intelligence community that missed the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so we can expect them to make extravagantly idiotic mistakes. And there's no other way to describe what happened. I mean, when I first saw that image, I've never seen the second image personally, but the first image, I looked at it and I thought, that's not a UFO. It's obviously not. I mean, I was seeing it on on a screen. It was clear to me. It was instantly clear. And I can't believe it wasn't instantly clear to him. How many UFO images has he seen in his career? He must have seen many. So I'm having trouble believing it wasn't an intentional thing. That it wasn't, and yet at the same time, the prelude where he had it on his phone and everybody knew about it, and then he says that it was just handed to him by a pilot and implies that he didn't really have a chance to look into it too carefully. That suggests to me it was a genuine mistake. And in either case, what is going on here? Because as you said, he is a professional, long-term counterintelligence officer. It is a very difficult, complex profession that requires high-level analytical skills and a very sharp mind. And none of that was on display. So what was going on? It's just terribly mysterious to me. Now I want to go on to talk a little bit about Jake Barber and Jake's basically the thing that has stood out for me about Jake's marvelous testimony to a great degree, I think. There's one thing though that scared me, and he admitted that they were shooting at these things, which is a great admission because I've known that for years from the visitor side as well as ours. And make no mistake, they don't like it. The bodies that are involved are not like our bodies. When your body dies, you're not coming back into this time stream on your own. You come back, you're drawn back in magnetically by another body that you have some, but not a lot of control over what's going to happen to it. And that's the whole point. If you had control over it, you wouldn't be experiencing your life as novel. It would be like living in a state of permanent deja vu. So you don't want that. It has to be kind of random. Now, they're not like that. They build these bodies, these biomechanical devices, to inhabit, and they inhabit them. And the short 3 foot tall ones are expendable. In other words, one of the more biologically complex ones with many, many more points of contact between soul and body, they don't want that body to be hurt. And so they will deploy these other little bodies which they can penetrate into and use as avatars. They're like biorobots that are telepathically connected to the main body, I think. So they don't really care that they get destroyed, but when we destroy them, that means we're being aggressive and stupid in ways that tell them we don't want to necessarily engage with these people on any in any serious way. Recently, a friend of mine had a close encounter experience at her home, and I knew the group that went to her home, and I know why they went. And that's, it's not a secret, but it's part of a confidentiality agreement that has to do with something in the creative world. So I'm not going to tell that part of it, but suffice to say, it's no huge earth-shaking thing. But when she was there, the being that you're looking at her back there was there. Her three of her guardians, the little 3-foot-tall ones, were pacing back and forth in the living room of the lady, and the lady was in her bedroom, and the being was peeking into the bedroom, and they were pacing back and forth, making their noises. They sort of go like that. They make noises because they're scared. They're worried about who they're protecting, and they don't like them to come close to human beings. So that's kind of there. That's their relationship with us, and that's about as far as it's going to go. So now Jake Barber comes and he shoots at him. And does that mean that what kind of relationship do we have here? Kelly, do you think that when he shoots at him, they're shooting at him?
I mean, that's what's so hard about so much of this contact going through kind of the military.
Yeah.
Like is that I don't know that the military is our best ambassador for this kind of contact.
Not at all, not even close.
And I mean, something that actually Jake Barber and Lou Elizondo have in common is that, like, they both have backgrounds that are, like, kind of scary. Like,
Yeah.
these are men who have been involved in some pretty awful things. And, like, I don't say that as a judgment. I understand that, like, I get to sleep at night because there are people who work for our government who do things that, like, I can't imagine that I probably wouldn't be willing to do and that
Yeah,
I don't want to
they
know
must not be
about.
condemned for what they did because they kept us safe. That's
Right.
both of them did things that were terrifying and kept us safe and dangerous to them.
Exactly. But I also, so like that doesn't come from like, that's not a moral judgment, but it is a question of like, in the case of, Jake Barber or others, are these energetically like the best people to be making contact or also just in terms of, I don't know, like what their particular skill sets are and what their And I'm not sure that that's the case. I don't know how we would change it. I think that that's kind of a foregone conclusion, but it certainly makes me wonder about what the outcomes will be.
Do you think that any of these people are ever going to get used to the idea that they should be engaging publicly with the experiencers? Because they won't interview with me. I don't know if they'll interview with you. You and I are two of a very small number of experiencers, and Jay, of course. Who are out there doing podcasts and being frankly open about the fact that we are experiencers.
I mean,
It's.
as I've become kind of more independent in my thinking, and as I become more open about being an experiencer, there's definitely doors that have closed that used to be a little more open. I don't think that they the what I find so fascinating is this dichotomy between the fact that the intelligence community is fiercely, obsessively, like demonstrably obsessed with experiencers, that experiencers are tracked, that that they know who experiencers are, that they're desperate for the information that and the experiencer like they're desperate for the information that experiencers have about the contact that they've had and about the beings that they've seen and about technology that they've maybe encountered. Like they're desperate for all of that, but then like publicly they won't engage with it. And
Yeah,
so
that's my experience exactly.
Yeah, and so I just think that I think it really comes back to the fact that like It's, I think it's about power, and I think it's about control. And I think that there's
Right.
too much truth that experiencers could speak that they don't, and that so they want to learn from experiencers, but the last thing they want to do is legitimize experiencers.
Well, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, because as soon as they ex legitimize the experiencers, suddenly they're not in control anymore, because the experiencers know a whole lot more about relating to the visitors than they do. Because you're not going to learn a lot about that by shooting at them. You are going to learn a lot about it by making a relationship with them, which we do. A lot of us have had very rich, complex relationships with them. Now, getting back to Jake, at one point in his interview with Ross Coulthart, he talks about how he's not in ontological shock anymore. He's in ontological relief, because he was possessed by a wonderful feminine presence that's still part of him and that he's in love with. And, that gets that. I thought to myself, they really don't understand that level of weapon yet. They don't understand. He wasn't possessed by a feminine presence. His aggression was neutralized by a weapon which exposed him to a certain frequency that his soul reacted to, a weapon of a kind they know nothing about. But that which we experiencers, a lot of us have experienced that type of weapon in our own lives. So, and I thought, well, little does he know that he wasn't being charmed, he was being neutralized. He might as well have been put in a box and put on a shelf, because he's not going to be shooting at anyone anymore, is he? Who he's in love with, a goddess or whatever. And we have a. There's a whole religious element to this thing, that like inside the Air Force, and there's this supposed Collins elite, but I've never been able to track them down. But I do know it's true in the Air Force, because it was true of my Uncle Mickey. I think it was true of my Uncle Mickey. I'm not going to, and I never, no, pretty sure it was true of Arthur Exon, General Exon, whom I also knew, that they were pretty sure that they were dealing with the demonic presence. And in other words, they had folded it into the religion. Where do we go with that? Because I don't think this has anything to do with any of our religions.
I don't know. I think I've remained personally kind of radically agnostic about the religious aspect of it, because it does seem to, there are ways in which it seems to be related in that it impacts our beliefs about ourselves, about our place in the cosmos, about like our relation to the divine in some ways, like. And so there seems to be some kind of a connection there. I do think it's dangerous to just skin it with whatever like your particular belief system is, because I think that makes it harder to see, and I think it makes people easier to be confused or controlled in the situation. You know, I think that there's like a middle ground that I try to stay with, where I recognize that I think it's important to recognize the similarities between like what we would call angels and demons and like various aspects of the phenomenon, without then reducing the phenomenon to angels and demons. Like, I think that there's a middle ground in there.
An intellectual stance that's non-reductive, that is much more powerful and much more likely to result in some kind of viable contact relationship. Because I don't think if we have people out there saying it's the Blessed Virgin Mary or some Egyptian goddess or another, or that it's demons and it's angels and all of that. That's like putting a screen between us and them, and trying to see through holes in the screen. You need no screen. If you don't have a screen, what you see on the other side, what I see are complex people, beings, who are often tired, often scared, and trying very hard to do something that I know I don't fully understand, because what I understand of it would not result in them being so determined as they are. Therefore, there are parts of it I don't understand, and I think those have to do with the soul. And I suspect that the soul is the whole center of this, that they've either found us or whatever, why ever they showed up here, and they hear these beings with these beautiful souls and their open doors. We don't know what we are, and therefore they can come in those doors, and God knows what they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a distinct possibility.
Yeah, it sure is. But what can we say? Let's talk a little bit about one good guy in this. And I mean, they're all good guys. I don't want to dump on David, Jake, or Lou. They're all trying hard to do something that is virtually impossible. I think John, who I interviewed on Dreamland, who was willing to come on the show because he's an experiencer himself, and his experiences have been happening, unfolding outside of the context of his official life. In other words, there was no one in the official world who could tell him what to say and not say, because he wasn't violating any security agreements in coming out. And he was a wonderful interview. I loved it. I loved it. I thought he was extremely frank and forthcoming. And I thought to myself at the time, I know the others would like to be the same, but they can't. They're dancing a dance, and the dancing master is hidden.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with that. And I do find Blitch to be really interesting. And, I think when people hear me talk skeptically of people like Lou Elizondo, they think I'm like trying to paint him as a villain. And I'm like, that's really not at all what I'm doing. Because I think there's other questions to be asked. I think we'd be dumb not to ask the question, like, is he doing it on purpose? But I think that there's a lot of other questions to ask. Like, has he been compromised? Are there things going on, like against his will? Like, are there things going on behind the scenes? Are there threats? Are there something? Are there, like, is he not thinking clearly because he's got too many other concerns, maybe some really scary concerns? Or was he threatened? Is he being given information, like bad information on purpose by people that he's been made to trust? Like, there's a million questions to ask. And I think, the thing that I have become really aware of is that, like, it's not easy to be in the intelligence community. Like, it is, in many ways, the intelligence community is like the world's most elaborate hostage situation. And that the people involved don't, in many ways, once you, it's a Faustian bargain. Once you become a part of that community, there's a way in which you are, do not belong to yourself anymore. And I think that that must be, and I think that, the people who do it almost, probably all or most of them do it for altruistic reasons because they want to serve their country and they want to protect their country. But the things that losing your ability to say what you think or to do what you believe is the right thing to do in certain situations, I think is a an enormous sacrifice and an enormous burden and something that like we don't think about what it's like, the reality of that, that these people aren't gatekeepers, they're hostages. And that's something I think about a lot.
The Whistleblower Act does not free people to say publicly anything they want about what they're blowing the whistle on. It frees them to a certain extent, but it's very directed and very compromised. They have to be there. What they're going to say has to be vetted. So, as far as I know, the people who have come forward so far, except for John, as I said earlier, have not been free to say necessarily exactly what they want and all they want, mainly all they want. And I'm just wondering if that would change, because there's pressure in the Congress. It's much less pressure now than it was a year ago, by the way, much less. because there's fewer congresspeople are pushing it. They're not pushing it as hard as they used to. We have one or two heroes right now, and that's it. The Senate's more or less gone past it. So will they ever be able to be free to say what they want to say more?
I don't think so. Like, I don't know what
Yeah,
would
either.
change that would make that possible. I don't, and I think that the implications of what's being hidden are so vast and so wide-reaching that I can't imagine. I think we might get disclosure by degrees, but I can't imagine that they're just going to let the cat out of the bag. Which is okay. You know what I mean? Like I said before, this isn't something that they own. Like, this is the nature of our reality, and it seems to be very deeply tied to what it means to be human. And in some ways, I think that we need to reclaim our agency and to stop waiting for the government to tell us. You know, I know so many people in the community are already there. I'm unfortunately preaching to the choir, but you know, in my work, increasingly, I'm paying less and less attention to what's going on in disclosure and more attention to, you know, how do I do more outreach to people who aren't where I'm not preaching to the choir? Like, how do we make inroads with the public at large, and how do we push this conversation and forward in ways that isn't directly tied to the success or failure of the disclosure movement? And I think that that's probably that's where I'm putting my energy and attention now, because I think that disclosure and that disclosure by degrees can help, right? It can break the ice. It can make people consider things maybe they hadn't before. Certainly, you know, I'm here because of it. I don't know that all of that would have happened if I hadn't started getting curious. And so, you know, I think it's a good thing, but I don't think that it stops there. I think that we are disclosure, and that more people need to stop waiting for the government to hand it to us and realize that it's ours to take if we want to and if we take it seriously.
The disclosure movement has co-opted some of our agency, I think. And for example, if you go on most of the big shows, they're not talking to many experiencers anymore. They want those authority figures from the government. They want people with creds. And that agency actually belongs to us because the people with the creds, when it comes to the close encounter experience, they either can't talk about it in the ways they would like to, or they don't know enough about it to do so. And you know, you can tell in seconds when they start to talk about it how much they know, how well they know the visitors. And so far, I haven't seen any of them who really seem to know. I've suspected that David Grush might know. I have suspected that. And as I alluded to earlier, or said earlier, I thought he might be an experiencer himself. Jim Semivan and his wife, they know. They've had experiences, and they've been perfectly straightforward about it. Or Jim has. His wife doesn't make many public statements. But for the most part, if these people are experiencers, or there are experiencers or people on an interface, which I've heard about again and again over the years, inside the government, we don't get that. We're not getting any of that. And so the agency goes to people who don't have the authority to capture that agency, but are given it anyway by the media because they have credentials. Irrelevant credentials is what happens.
Well, I mean, I think
Okay.
that's the thing, that's the disclosure, and which is why I'm skeptical of it. One of the many reasons is because I think one of the things that the disclosure movement has been most successful in accomplishing since 2017 is entirely reorienting the field of ufology toward the intelligence community,
Yeah.
and that it's become this situation where it's essentially a question and answer session with the people who've been lying about this from the beginning. And that
Right.
suddenly, like, that's where all of our, you know, there's no one in the world, almost no community in the world, that should have more reasons to be suspicious of what we're being told by the intelligence community. And yet somehow since 2017, we've gotten to a place where those are the only people that you can take seriously. And certain of them, if you question them at all, like, God help you, because the backlash that you'll receive can be extraordinarily like nasty. And I'm not saying that like they're deputizing people to do that. I'm saying that like people are so invested in saying it, like in their own story of like this person is a hero and I trust this person, and they believe it so deeply that if anyone questions that it becomes like a real threat, and it becomes something that like is very emotional and very real for people, and that concerns me, because in some ways I feel like that like I said, that the UFO community of all communities should know better, and yet we find ourselves in this position.
Yeah, we should know better, but we don't. And authority has been transferred to people whose job is to manage information and to appear not to be doing so. And
Right.
so
Yes.
this is where we are now. And in that sense, the disclosure movement is a step backwards because, I know that if this was entirely up to experiencers, it would be a very different picture that would be emerging. Now, I have thought that one of the things that would happen if there was a moment when, at some very authoritative level, it was admitted that somebody was here, is that the experiencers might be re-granted their agency by the media. In the sense of thinking, well, hey, these are the people who've had this happen to them. But I also know that there are experiencers inside the government who we don't know yet, some of whom have had extensive connection with the presence and are at a very high level of understanding of this. And so it would still be them, I think. They would be the ones who would be turned to, people whose names we don't know yet. Kelly, look, give me a last word because we're getting to the, we I'm going to keep you I'm going to keep you for hours and hours if I'm not careful. So let's sum up. Where are we going, Kelly Chase? You're a brilliant investigator. You know that I'm going to get one of the best possible answers from you, and now you're on the spot.
Yeah, no pressure. Oh my gosh. I think that I don't think that this is a hopeless conversation or a pessimistic conversation. I think it's a realistic conversation. But to me, it regardless of whether anyone asks us to or gives us permission or deputizes us, this is in the hands of experiencers. We do have agency here. We do have an ability to make a difference in the world, and I think that we are every day, and I would love to see more and more people take that stance and to approach this from that perspective, because the nature of our reality is not something that can be hidden from us. It's not something that someone can gatekeep. It's something that we all have the ability to approach on our own and in our own souls, since we've used that word.
Yeah.
We all have the ability to do that. And so there's nothing that's holding us back, and there's nothing that's standing in our way. Where the work is in front of us. And, if I can know anything about experiencers, they're some of the most intelligent, sensitive, innovative, interesting people I've ever met in my life. And I have
Yes.
a lot of faith and a lot of hope about the future of ufology.
They're very bright people. They're very honest people for the most part. And they're very kind people. They're very, you get a group of experiencers together and you realize that the visitors have selected for mild-mannered people, probably because they're very small and we're very big. Kelly Chase, thank you so much for this. Cosmosis Media, cosmosis.com. I mean, cosmosis.media, the Cosmosis documentary, which you can get on Amazon, and the Cosmosis podcast, plus one precious dreamland every month, for which I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, thank you so much, Whitley. This has been so much fun.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.